This is Mishmash, a weekly conversation where we try to unjumble an important and sometimes under the radar statewide story that affects you. I'm Zach Gorcho.
And I'm Alethea Kasbin. The assassination attempt on former President Donald Trump has prompted several top leaders in Michigan to urge toning down the apocalyptic campaign rhetoric that dominates today's politics.
Leaders from Michigan Republican Party Chair Pete Hoekstra to Democratic Governor Gretchen Whitmer have called for lowering the temperature. Hoekstra made a point of referring to our Democratic friends this week when talking about the presidential election. And Whitmer warned the assassination attempt was but the latest in a string of violent actions against elected officials, from the shooting at a baseball practice congressional Republicans were having to the plot where men spoke of kidnapping and killing Whitmer.
Ahead of the Republican National Convention, which took place this week in Wisconsin, Michigan GOP Chair Hoekstra said the public has now seen what happens when rhetoric turns into violence, and referenced the death of Corey Campatori, who was killed at the Trump rally last week. Here's more of what he said in Wisconsin.
And it's scary. Okay, like we talked about, this poor family. They lost a dad. They lost a husband. Only 50 years old, and you know today they're going to wake up and there's going to be an empty spot at the breakfast table. It's awful. And so, you know, this kind of all puts it back in perspective. Politics is part of our lives. You know, family, faith are much more important than parts of our lives than politics.
It's still a raw time. Social media was full this week of rage from Republicans about the attempt on Trump's life, pointing at President Joe Biden recently saying Democrats needed to put Trump in a bullseye. These kinds of metaphors seem to flourish in politics today.
Yes, and as soon as anger from the right began flowing at Biden, the Democrats and the news media, many of those on the left said there could be no let-up in the criticism of Trump, and they immediately pointed to Trump mocking the hammer attack on Paul Pelosi, former Speaker Pelosi's husband, to turn it back on Republicans.
But there are definitely some cooler heads out there. State Representative Donnie Steele, a Republican from Orion, issued a heartfelt statement talking about, while she disagrees with Democrats like Biden, Whitmer, and State House Speaker Joe Tate on policy, she admires Whitmer and Tate as people and respects the office Biden serves.
You just have to wonder if American politics is up to this challenge. The whole operating philosophy in elections is to outrage your base to donate money and vote. Saying you disagree with an opponent on policy doesn't cut it in today's political strategies. It's more about casting them as someone who will bring ruin upon the nation and how they must be defeated.
You know, I think it's true that the tone is set at the top. Politicians were fundraising before rhetoric really started heating up. They can change the culture. What's really frustrating is for people like you and me who see at least some state-level politicians in action, for the most part, they get along. They might give a floor speech, absolutely decimating a policy they hate, and then go shake hands or hug or get dinner with the other side. Many everyday voters do not see that side. We talked to State Rep Mike Harris, a Waterford Republican, this week about that, and here's what he said.
You know, I've been critical of policies with the governor or some of my colleagues, you know, sometimes on both sides of the aisle. One of the things that helps me is I try to develop a relationship with some people before I have to have those conversations. And I think it makes the really tough conversations easier to have because you've already developed a mutual respect for each other. And whether, you know, you go out at the end of the day and have dinner or not, at least there's a professional relationship there.
Relationships generally appear more bleak at the federal level, and even talk of bipartisanship seems less common. You have those who work to promote agreements and friendships with the other side of the aisle, including our own Congresswoman Debbie Dingell and former Congressman Fred Upton, but it seems less frequent.
Like you said, Zach, this is a challenge facing our politicians right now, and it's months before a key election. You know, I think everyone has some reflecting to do about how they address their opponents and how we want our politics to look in the years ahead.
We're going to take a quick break, but stick around, because when we come back, we're going to be joined by State Representative Mike Harris, a Waterford Republican and former police officer, about security at political events and the political climate. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Mishmash. I'm Alethea Kasbin.
And I'm Zach Orichow. Joining us now is State Representative Mike Harris, a Waterford Republican in his third year serving in the Michigan House following a 30-year law enforcement career. Representative Harris, welcome to Mishmash.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
This has been a difficult week. The nation came the closest to the assassination of a current or former president in 43 years when former President Donald Trump was shot in the ear at a Pennsylvania rally. One of his supporters was shot and killed in the gunfire, and two others were critically injured. Representative Harris, based on your career in law enforcement, you know, what went wrong here from a security standpoint?
You know, it's always hard to armchair quarterback this. It's, you know, in my time in law enforcement, I had the privilege of working with the Secret Service a few different times in some presidential details. As you may know, Oakland County has its own international airport, and it becomes kind of a hub for VIPs and dignitaries coming into town to avoid the crowd in Detroit. So, you know, the Secret Service has always been a really well-oiled machine. They're truly a professional organization, and we've learned a lot from them, you know, whether it's their advanced planning and dignitary protection, the current tactical program that, you know, they run. I mean, they're really an impressive machine. Looking at, you know, we can't plan for everything, and looking at all the things that potentially could go wrong that, you know, organizations like the Secret Service try and train for, you still can't accommodate for everything. And there's so many unanswered questions right now, which is why I'm glad that there's an investigation going on to really dig into those unanswered questions and see if we can figure out where we went wrong.
So can you describe how the Secret Service and local law enforcement are supposed to mesh at an event like this? You mentioned you were involved in a number of these.
Yeah, so at least back in the time where I worked on these presidential details, you know, there was instant communication between Secret Service and law enforcement, local law enforcement. I've even had instances where I've had to call in a potential threat of something that was going on. For example, I believe it was the Obamas that came through on a train in Waterford, and we had a couple of people start walking up towards the tracks. It was such an instantaneous response by the Secret Service once it got called in. I would have to believe those protocols are still priority for them, right? They want to jump on things as soon as they know about them. Obviously, not being at this event, it's really hard to tell what details caused an opening in the security issue. But normally, you know, there's briefings that happen with local law enforcement. Like I said, there's usually communication arrays that are set up. So there's usually instantaneous conversations that can happen between Secret Service and local law enforcement. So knowing what they're doing a couple years after I got out of the game is, you know, I can only imagine the idea is that it's improved with technology and evolving tactics.
Okay, so, you know, you mentioned there is an investigation, you know, that's happening. There's going to be likely multiple investigations in the weeks ahead. And there are questions, you know, that people have that need to be answered. What questions are in your mind right now after seeing what happened over the weekend? What do you want answered?
You know, I think a lot of it, and I'm glad it's a bipartisan issue, so we don't turn this political. We look at hopefully just the facts of the case. You know, debriefings, whether it's internally with the Secret Service, internally with the law enforcement agencies that were involved, and then, you know, the public investigation that's going on at the federal level. I think some of the things that need to be asked are obviously, you know, who was responsible for covering certain areas around the venue. Open air venues are really, really tough to manage. And, you know, it enlarges the number of problems that could happen. So, you know, but my experience has been there's always someone responsible for different areas. So who was responsible for that? How did this get missed? What was the delay in communication, if any, between local law enforcement or bystanders seeing this person on the roof and action actually taking place? I think those are some of the main things that we need to get to. And then there's a lot more probably at a granular level to look at after that. But I think those are probably some of the top questions.
So after a traumatic event like this, it's kind of follows a similar pattern sometimes where there's been a range of responses, in this case from the Republicans, because it was their party's president who was shot. You know, some are furious with President Biden and the Democrats, saying their criticism of Trump created a climate for someone to try to kill him. And others have called for lowering the temperature, that while this is a very emotional time, there's also lots of blame to go around in both parties when it comes to vilifying elected officials in the other party. And what are your thoughts today? I suppose there's probably a range of emotions yourself that you've been feeling.
There is. And, you know, probably day by day, some of that range, you know, expands or contracts. You know, I think we all probably play into the responsibility here for where the country's gone with rhetoric and villainization of, you know, key political figures. And, you know, again, I think we all probably can point our fingers at ourselves at some point where we have, instead of attacking policy, we're attacking the person. And I think we need to get away from that. You know, villainization of people, even though we disagree, is not a good look for any of us. And this is not what our country should be. And, you know, you have people, regardless of whether you agree with their philosophies or not, that are serving the public. They are making a lot of sacrifices with their family, their time, to do what they believe is right. Now, whether we all believe their policies are right or not, I think, again, that's something we can be critical of on the policy level, but I think we need to get away from actually villainizing their character.
So, you know, is there a way, and how, you know, because I think, you know, this, the kind of the rhetoric in politics has been sort of years in the making, right? We've seen it, you know, this didn't just happen overnight. So how Correct. Do we, and you as a politician, how do you kind of change the culture around how to describe the opposition? You know, is there a way to outline these major policy differences that, you know, is the key to the disagreement without enraging people?
Sure. And you guys know well, you know, I've been critical of policies with the governor or some of my colleagues, you know, sometimes on both sides of the aisle. You know, in police work, we learn a lot about de-escalation, a lot about handling very hostile people and trying to still control that situation that we're in. And I'd like to think that I've taken a lot of lessons that I've learned in law enforcement and brought them into the political world. And I think a good piece of that is learning how to talk to people. And I think sometimes we tend to escalate things because we are either fearful of where this is going to go, or we are just so passionate about a topic that we just kind of fly off the handle versus sitting back. And I think one of the things that helps me is I try to develop a relationship with some people before I have to have those conversations. And I think it makes the really tough conversations easier to have because you've already developed a mutual respect for each other. And whether, you know, you go out at the end of the day and have dinner or not, at least there's a professional relationship there. And, you know, you can talk about whether it's the weather or, you know, a car problem that you just had, or if we're talking about a tough issue that we're working on policy wise. And I think it just, we're so scared to talk to each other anymore. And I think we need to get away from that. And if we really focus on building the relationships, we can talk about anything else.
So sort of in that same vein, you've been working with Representative Brenda Carter, a Democrat from the neighboring district over in Pontiac, on bills to combat insurance fraud. You and Representative Carter probably disagree on a lot of things other than that you want the best for, you know, Central Oakland County. But how does substantive bipartisan work like that take place?
You know, again, it's one of those things. So she's the chair of the Insurance and Financial Services Committee, and I'm the Republican vice chair. And, you know, I think we went into it having already talked, you know, prior to committee work and whatnot. And again, we just kept building on that relationship. And, you know, Brenda is a wonderful person. She's a good human being. I've gotten to know her and her husband both. And we talk outside of the chamber as well, you know, and I think that's something that when it comes to dealing with policy, because there's much policy that we don't agree with. Zach, you hit it right on the head. But we have a mutual respect for each other. We enjoy each other's company. And we can have disagreeing talks, but we still treat each other well. But it's that relationship piece, I think, is really key. And sharing a community, we both share Waterford. She has kind of the southern half of Waterford, and I have the northern half. And, you know, we all know that working together is going to better our communities instead of just fighting all the time. So we try and do, you know, handle Waterford as a team effort and really kind of have each other's backs on things. So
I think, you know, in the last decade or so, you know, you hear more and more on social media or just kind of funny. Normally it's quips about like, don't bring politics up at the Thanksgiving table, or you can't, you know, talk to your neighbor about politics if you don't agree. You know, what would you say to someone who feels like the rift that's only over politics is just too wide to bridge?
If we don't start moving the needle, I think we're going to have a bigger problem in the future. And, you know, it used to be you could talk about just about anything at the dinner table. And I think the dinner table has been replaced by social media or texting or whatnot. And we have a harder time looking each other in the face and actually talking about things that are uncomfortable. And if we can't do it at our own dinner table, I think we have a harder time teaching our children to be able to do it outside of the home. So I'm a firm believer that, you know, the less we talk about something, the more uncomfortable it becomes in the future. And, you know, politics, unfortunately, even though it can be uncomfortable, it's if we just ignore it, we end up with people that don't want to be active in voting or having a process to, you know, elect the officials they think are going to, you know, represent them best in Washington or the state or even locally. So I think we need to get back to talking about it. We just need to realize that we need to reel in the emotions with it and maybe just talk factually instead of all the conjecture.
How do you think our leaders at the top have reacted to what happened Saturday in Pennsylvania? Are you satisfied with what you've heard from President Biden and former President Trump since the assassination attempt?
You know, I do appreciate that they've both called for unity and they have both admonished the fact that violence has no place in politics. I think they're both bringing back the idea, at least in, you know, their initial responses, that we need to look at, again, policies and things like that versus trying to demonize the other person. Now, whether that's, you know, the rhetoric goes back to what it was, I don't know, but at least the initial calling for the country to unify and admonish any violence when it comes to, you know, the political realm, I think is key.
I'm curious if you see a difference in how officials get along at the state and local level compared to in Congress or in the national spotlight. You know, what do you think those who serve in DC can learn from local governments or people at the state level like you?
Well, you know, I think it goes back and forth. There's probably things that we see at the federal level that, you know, we learn a lot at the state level from, and vice versa. You know, sometimes comments that get put out there are, you know, politically based or, you know, are there to evoke certain responses or certain support or get support away from, you know, another issue. I just hope that regardless of whether it's DC, state, local, again, I think it's all getting back to let's criticize policy and stop criticizing a person's character, or at least vilifying something where, again, they're taking on a huge burden by, and I think the argument is, well, they get paid to deal with these burdens and whatnot, but you know, it's like police work. We don't pay police officers to want to get shot at, you know, and yeah, I got shot at before my career ended and it was scary. It scared my whole family. So I can only imagine what the Trump family is dealing with, you know, or anybody else that's been involved in that. Or by God, the person that was killed at the rally and the people that were injured. And I'm sure that plays into fears and concerns that everybody has that the federal, state, and local level. I hope we really take notice of where we've gotten to here and can reverse some of that rhetoric.
All right, Representative Harris, thank you so much for joining us on Mishmash today.
Yeah, anytime. It's good seeing you guys.
Thanks again to our guest, Representative Mike Harris from Waterford. Mishmash is produced by WDET, Detroit's NPR station, in collaboration with Gongwer News Service. Mishmash is hosted and produced by me, Alethea Kasman, Zach Gorchow, and Shayna Roth.
Additional production and editing by Hearns Laguerre Jr. Mixing, mastering, and music by Sam Bobian.
Our digital team is Dave Kim, Sophia Joswiak, and Jenny Sherman. Our news director is Jerome Vaughn, and our podcast manager is David Lyons. As always, if you listen to this podcast and want to support it, you can do so by leaving us a review or comment wherever you listen. You can subscribe or follow us on Spotify, Apple, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Tell your friends about how much you've learned from Mishmash and send them a link. Learn more about Gongwer News Service at GONGWER.com.
Remember, we're produced by a public radio station, which means we are listener supported. So if you really, really like this podcast, you can support WDET by going to WDET.org/give.